You're listening to Trek FM.
Want to join in the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners' discussion group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field, and we look forward to seeing you there.
This is Steve Sansweet of Rancho Obi-Wan, and you're listening to the 602 Club.
Well, hello and welcome to TFM's local watering hole for all those discussions outside of Star Trek. And I'm so excited to be back with my good friend Christy Morris, because Christy, we've got a brand new, well, the final Mission Impossible movie to discuss this evening.
Yes. I'm so excited. The final reckoning. It's here. Number 8.
Yes. I can't believe that it has taken this long. It feels like we have been waiting for this film forever. But I'm really excited that it's finally come out into the theaters, and that means that we get an opportunity to talk about it. Quick reminder to everybody, though, you know, wherever you get your podcast, just make sure you're subscribed so you get the 602 Club as soon as the episode drops. And then, you know, it's something like Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Those are places that allow you to rate or review a podcast. And so we would really appreciate if you would do that for the show. It really does help. And it's been a while since we've had a review. In fact, it's been over a year at this point. So we would love to have you review us. You can also find us on social media. We're on X Twitter at the 602 Club. We're also on Instagram at the 602 Club TFM. You can also find us online at Trek.fm. You can find the entire network on Facebook at Facebook.com/Trek.fm. And there is a listeners-only discussion group that you can join on Facebook called the Babel Conference. You just type that into the search field. You can find it. You can join and talk to listeners from all over the world about the different shows that are happening here on the network. So, well, Christy, one of the things about this movie is that, you know, we've been waiting for quite a long time, because the previous film, Dead Reckoning, of course, then at that point it was called Part One, came out in 2023. It is 2025. And so, I wanted to just ask you, coming into this knowing that and thinking that it's going to be the final film, and where we were kind of left off at the end of, you know, that's part one, at least is what it was called last time. How are you feeling coming into this one, especially with the knowledge that this is probably, you know, the last Mission Impossible movie for Tom Cruise and the gang?
Definitely had a lot of mixed emotions. I think number one being, it's crazy feeling like this could possibly end. Because especially you and I being fans of other franchises that have gone on for a very long time, hint, hint, James Bond, Star Wars, you know, all kinds of things. When you do finally reach what they're saying is the conclusion, it feels like, okay, maybe this is natural and could be a good time to wrap it up in a nice little bow, but also kind of sad because the first Mission Impossible came out in 96.
Yeah.
And so we've been watching these movies since then. I mean, that is a long time.
I mean, it is a long time. It's 30 years of my life that I've been watching these films. You know, I have an incredibly vivid memory of seeing the first one, the first time in the theater. As I was watching it, my ankle was growing to be the size of a cantaloupe because I had hurt myself before we went and saw it, and I still went and saw the movie, regardless of the pain that I was in, and so because I was not going to miss this. And yeah, I mean, it's been one of those things. Like I'm with you. It's kind of a strange thought process to be like, oh yeah, we're not going to get any more of these movies after this, and you know. This is one of those absolutely rare series where I do feel as though every movie has really just felt better than the last. And yeah, and so I very, very excited to dive into talking about this one with you. And of course, in all of the changes that happened, this movie, of course, is not called Dead Reckoning Part 2. This movie moved to being The Final Reckoning, and they renamed the previous film just Dead Reckoning. But this movie also just kind of picks up where the story left off, in the fact that the entity is kind of in control of most people's reality here. And it seems as though Ethan is the only one, strangely enough, who might be able to stop this. And so I wanted to ask you about that, just kind of like as the movie's beginning and everything, and the fact that we actually only just, there's been 2 months that have passed between this movie and the last movie. Did you think that that was kind of the right way to start this, to basically pick up like, you know, almost no time had passed?
Yes. And I say that for two reasons. For one, the original plan was that these would be filmed back to back, and then it ended up changing later. So that was kind of, I think, what everyone was expecting anyway, especially the way that Dead Reckoning ended. Was that it would be a quick jump to the next one. But also, I think that it just is kind of needed now that we had so much time between the releases to catch you up.
Yeah.
Because I remembered the entity, but I did kind of need that beginning to bring me back in. Like, okay, here's where we are. Let's set it up again.
Yeah.
Did you as well?
Yeah, I think that you made a really great point there, which is the movie recognizes, and I was listening to an interview actually with Christopher McQuarrie, and he was talking about that idea of, you know, all the time that unfortunately had passed between the two films. You know, it really wasn't necessarily all their fault. They had strikes that got in the way and all that kind of stuff. And so really setting the stage by playing that video with the president talking to Ethan, reminding you and everything, having the film actually start with the entity from its perspective, basically, was, I think, those two things were the perfect way to kind of draw you back into the world that you had left and remind you where you are. And in fact, I mean, I think you mentioning that brings up a question about that process, because this movie will do that the whole time. Every time they kind of have a callback to somebody, whether it was from Dead Reckoning or any of the previous Mission Impossible movies, they actually show you a clip of that. And so I wanted to ask you how that worked as well, because I think it really coincides with even just the way they started the movie. It's almost as if, you know, they don't assume anything, that just because you're a fan, you're going to remember every single moment or anything like that. And they really seem to be setting this movie up for, you know, fans, but also people who, well, goodness, what if this was the only Mission Impossible movie you've ever seen?
Right, yeah. And what we had said was a weakness of the whole Marvel saga was that you had to have seen every movie in order to understand what was currently happening. Here, they did such a good job with, just like you said, really giving you a lot of callbacks, showing clips from previous movies. I think the only one I noticed was the one we say shall not be named.
Yeah, yeah, they were.
They left that one out.
Moments of two, yes. There were just very, very quick moments of two in there, which was fascinating.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, we remember it exists.
Yep. But otherwise, it was great to have those flashbacks for the fans, but it didn't take away anything for new viewers.
Right. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
I think another question that kind of revolves around this too is that the choice was obviously made that if this is going to be the final reckoning, we're basically going to have this movie be the culmination of 30 years of Mission Impossible films. And so every movie previous to this one was basically put in context of leading to this point. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you got characters coming back and you got all that kind of stuff. But and more than just talking about the callbacks, which we'll talk about the connections later, but mm-hmm. I just wanted to ask you about that idea of having everything kind of be connected so it creates basically a 30-year saga. And was that the right choice for this film to do? Because, we've seen other movies, I think, try to do that and not do it as successfully. I mean, I think The Rise of Skywalker comes to mind. Mm-hmm. And so did that actually work for you then in this movie?
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was brilliant the way that they did that because more than anything, really tying it back to the original first mission, I think you have to remind people, both fans and newbies alike, of why Ethan got into this, where his origin story comes from, and how the IMF even works and everything. I think that it was great to rebuild that foundation that then informs what's going to happen in the rest of this movie. So it's relatable, but also it all is lined up in a good way. I really love that they don't just explain it to you, that they're showing actual clips from the previous films, which I don't believe I've seen a lot in other movies where they're doing this kind of wrap up from every single one like that. So I was really impressed. I thought that it helped a lot and also really made me feel kind of emotional.
Yeah, I mean, I get that too. It's interesting because I think, you know, one of the main thematic elements of this film is the refrain that Luther says a couple of times, which is our lives are the sum of our choices, right? Mm-hmm. It's not just one choice, but it's all of them together. And I think because of that, tying all of this together, you know, this series as a whole really becomes about the sum of Ethan's choices. And so when he followed orders and when he didn't follow orders and all of the choices he made as the desire that he has, which is, you know, to save the world. And I thought that's the thing that actually made this work, because that's legitimately kind of in the last few movies, really the thematic element that they think they've been building to in the first place, which is, yeah, your life is the sum of your choices. And it's in that then, that is how, at least according to this movie, you know, we would weigh whether a life was a good life or a bad one. And, mm-hmm. and so I think then, to ask the question of, you know, whether or not it kind of works to contextualize the entire series that way so that everything becomes more cohesive, I think it works in that sense, mm-hmm. because of what they're trying to kind of do with this character. And in some ways, I think it speaks to the idea that that's how our lives are. Right. And so I really like that. I thought that it worked pretty well. And you know, kind of you mentioned that this movie kind of deals with the choice, right? You know, mm-hmm. you have the IMF team members, and the way that they become part of the IMF is that they are given the choice. You can join us, or, you know, usually it's you can go to prison because they've done something. Mm-hmm. They are, you know, when they decide to join, their motto is that, and their vow is that we live and die in the shadows for those we hold close and for those we never meet. And really, I thought that playing that out, that all of the actions that Ethan has taken have had all of these interesting consequences. And some of them we actually get to see the way in which they've been, they may have seemed to impact somebody negatively at one point in their lives, but have become positive other points in their lives. Mm-hmm. And how even actions like, you know, we were talking about again, this idea of connecting the films. So it's like, you know, you're stealing the rabbit's foot, but then you find out the rabbit's foot is what it actually was. And so in the end, I think one of the things that's interesting about the film, and because it's this 30-year saga, really the whole idea of choice and whether maybe it was the right choice, the wrong choice, has to do with perspective.
Yeah.
And the perspective then that time gives us to be able to look back, because, you know, we always say hindsight's 20/20. And in some ways, that's kind of what this movie is doing in an interesting way with Ethan and all the choices that he's made, and whether or not they're good or not. And really, that kind of brings to light this thing, which you have, I think, you see Ethan in many of the films, where he's just kind of carrying the weight of the world, but he's also carrying the weight of his own past. He's carrying the weight of the choices he's made. You know, when you think about him marrying Julia and then having to put her into witness protection. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was such a great way for this film to play with the character. And again, to really use this film to put everything in perspective so that we can leave the character in a place where hopefully we feel there to be like a resolution, because the sum of all of Ethan's choices has led to the salvation of the world once again.
Yeah. And like I was thinking too, even as you're saying that, there are multiple different ways of even looking at what this means for the movie and the character. I think it also comes across as, to me, in our lives, there are millions of different directions we could go depending on what choices we make. And that none of us are a victim of anything in our life, that we have always ended up where we are through some choice we made. You know, I mean, that obviously there are things that happen that are outside your control, but that you're never a victim of destiny or something like that. That it's, you know, you are making choices and that is what drives your life forward. So I liked that angle of this as well. And then Luther's speech really bringing that home, I think. And then also with this whole discussion on choices and the way that their motto was always that they live and die in the shadows, for those they hold close and for those they will never meet. It reminded me a lot of just even the military.
Yeah.
That they're not necessarily in the shadows, obviously, but that there are so many people in our military that I will never meet, for example, but that they've made that choice to serve anyway and selflessly do this thing to save the world, possibly.
Yeah.
So I like all these different ways of looking at that as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I'm glad that you brought that up, the idea of the speech Luther gives at the end, because that kind of becomes the great juxtaposition between Ethan and just about every other character throughout the series, which is, you know, Luther is basically saying something that we've talked about ad nauseum really on this show, because so many movies are kind of discussing this idea, which is, are you going to live life only for yourself and for what you can get out of it? Or are you going to be a person who lives by basically the golden rule, somebody who is willing to lay down their life for another? You know, are we going to be driven by our base instincts as human beings, which are not good?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think anybody can argue that. Or are we going to live up to the better angels of our nature? And that's what this movie is kind of arguing that we should be doing, that we should be living, you know, for kindness and trust and mutual understanding. And it's fuzzy because, you know, I think as much as I like his speech, the whole idea, you know, of him saying that a future reflecting the measure of good within ourselves and all that is good inside of us is measured by the good we do for others, which there's a lot of truth to that. But as we see throughout the film, and just in general with the Mission Impossible films, most people are kind of really just living for themselves, and they're the good in them is the good that they can get out of something, you know, like,
yeah.
And so I think it's fascinating because the answer is good, but it's also not great as an actual answer. Yes, it's better if we live for others than ourselves. But to say the good inside of us, it's like the movie has just kind of shown us so many times that most people have at least equal parts good and bad. At least that's what the movie's kind of giving us, or more, you know, bad than good. And so,
yeah.
I don't know. I felt a little bit like it's a good answer, but it's not the best answer because it still kind of leaves you feeling like, wow, if that's kind of the answer for everybody to have to look for the good inside of themselves.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's really going to help that much.
Right. Well, and I'm glad you said that because that immediately reminds me of Grace having to be saved by Ethan when they were thinking they were about to be tortured. And she's horrified seeing what he does to these two guys in front of her.
Yes.
And then
yes.
At the end,
yes.
It's kind of like Luther making this speech saying that, like, Ethan is, like, our savior. But
yeah.
Ethan's got demons.
Yeah.
He just murdered two people. He's murdered a lot of people.
Yeah.
So it's not like, oh, he's the angel that just came down and gave his life for everyone else.
Yeah, I mean, yes, there's a real sense in the film almost where there is this messianic figure known as Ethan Hunt.
Right.
And yet, yeah, I mean, we see him, you know, there's the whole question of, like, you know, is he's protecting Grace, you know, and all those kind of things, right? And it's played off as a funny scene. But I think you bring up a great point. That, I think, does show some of the darkness that is actually in Ethan, right? Maybe it's being channeled for better uses.
Mm-hmm.
You could argue maybe those guys have families. I don't know. So, but yeah, I thought it was fascinating, though, that as we've been talking about this, and the movie clearly is about the choices we make in life, right?
Mm-hmm.
And those choices driving us. Because really, this movie is so much a commentary on spending too much time on the internet. Because, you know, the villain is basically the internet becomes sentient.
Yeah.
This digital devil who's created a reality all his own to enslave the human race. And did you catch the fact that this movie's villain, the entity, basically wants to do the same thing Drax wants to do in Moonraker, which is he wants to create a remnant of humanity that he will then lead as their god, basically?
Mm-hmm. Like a genocide? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I try to forget about Moonraker personally, but I do remember.
That's understandable. That's understandable. So,
but yeah, I mean, I thought it was hilarious that they even had that throwaway line at one point. You spend too much time on the internet. Because it is true, especially now with AI, seeing it more and more in ChatGPT and everything, it can be an excellent tool. But I think this is the perfect example of how it can just take off and grow a mind of its own. And we're already seeing some issues with AI in real life. of people thinking, well, if I just plug in these things, then the answer is automatically going to come out like this. And it comes out as something totally screwed up. And you're like, how did this happen? So, yeah, I mean, it's still a machine. It's still a tool. And we need to monitor how we use it. And I think you see that here for sure as sort of a foretelling of what could happen.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the fascinating thing, and like you said, you know, we've already seen plenty of places where AI could be incredibly dangerous, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I thought that, you know, talking about the idea of the messianic figure of Ethan, I mean, he's literally going against the entity which he calls the father of lies, which is one of the names of Satan in scripture.
Yeah.
And the idea of the place that we find ourselves where people can spend their whole life in a reality that is of their own choosing because an algorithm can create a digital echo chamber that doesn't actually conform to what's true or what's actually real. And in so many ways, we find, you know, human beings trying to play God, and it is creating massive, massive problems, obviously, you know, for the world. And, you know, I think it's very interesting the way in which something we'll talk about in a couple of weeks with Andor. You know, that also kind of plays into this whole idea with that speech Mon Mothma gives in the season two episodes. And so it is just very interesting to me that, you know, obviously even those in Hollywood and like we all seem to be seeing this problem. And we all seem to be, you know, whole books have been coming out about this where you talk about like Jonathan Haidt's The Anxious Generation and what social media and those type of things are doing to our youth, let alone just ourselves as well. You know, you and I are not exempt from these things.
Mm-hmm.
And yet we just keep, you know, barreling down the road as if like none of these things are a problem, which I think, you know, yes, this is a big action movie and all that kind of stuff. But I really do think that what this movie is trying to say in the villain of the entity where we have to come to a place where we actually prize what is true and what is right and what is good and all of those things over
augmented reality.
Over augmented reality. That I think that's a great way to put it. This you know, kind of demented digital demon who is, you know, trying to control us. And it what's crazy is that it's a demented digital demon of our own making.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we've literally done this to ourselves. And so when we talk about the idea of, like, you know, Luther's discussion at the end and what he says to Ethan about the good we find in ourselves and the good we can do for others, I think that's where, you know, what the film says on the villain side and then what we can do really are at a juxtaposition, because the entity is a villain of our own making.
Mm-hmm.
We've willingly done it to ourselves. And so I think this movie blatantly and very ardently is trying to say, hey, maybe we should be willing to slow our roll on all of these things because they're not actually helping. They're really hurting.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe what shouldn't be our God is convenience. Maybe what should be most important to us is whether something, you know, is actually good and true and right and real. That's, I think, a really powerful statement. It's one of the things I like about both of these movies so much is they're willing to kind of tackle this incredibly big question that we're all facing at this moment.
Yeah, I think everything you just said, we're definitely in agreement on. And I'd add to that as well. I think that so it's showing how we are creating whole other world, sort of like a like Ready Player One or whatever, where you get to create whoever you want to be for other people online. And even too, thinking about the way that education works, I think it's so interesting in the movie, they show how there's still analog ways of doing things that actually requires some education and training, like using a submarine and knowing Morse code and things like that. And AI and the complicatedness of the way the internet works now have actually made things so convenient and so easy that we don't have to learn those things anymore. The machine does it for us. And so maybe in that sense, it's actually making humanity go backwards in intelligence. Just putting it out there.
You know, yeah, I think that's a salient point. And I think, you know, it's also one of the things that as we as a human race have gotten farther and farther removed from the things that we make and the things that we eat and grow and all that. I mean, there's so much then that we become willing to accept because we don't have to be face to face with it in that. Right. So, I think about, where you get your clothes or where you get your technology and who created that and how is it made and all of those type of things. You know, you think about kind of the disgustingness of internet pornography and sex trafficking and all that kind of stuff that comes along with all of these things, where it's so easy then to brush it under the rug because it's made not just the daily conveniences that actually benefit our life, but it's made evil so much easier too.
Yeah.
And we've just made that trade as if it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Again, I think that's a really interesting question, and that is a really interesting question too, right? That's one of the choices here in the film, is do we choose to live in the entity's reality and become enslaved to him, or do we destroy ourselves so there's no chance of the entity winning? Or, and this is the thing, because they all talk about this, that the global economy would just be destroyed, that the world would basically end if we don't have all of these conveniences, because cyberspace would stop existing because of the end of the entity. Mm-hmm. And it's like, so you're willing to have either a remnant chosen by the entity who then has it as its god, or you're willing to just destroy yourselves without just maybe giving up some modern conveniences we have because of digital technologies and the internet. Like,
right.
You're willing to do one of those other two things, because that was kind of fascinating to me. And I almost wish that the movie had dwelled just a little bit longer on those, because wow, that's kind of what they're saying. Yeah, I can't live without the internet.
Right. And I think of that scene with the president saying there's always a choice, and that she made that one of, I choose to not play the game. You know, and so I thought that was a brilliant way of looking at it and showing that those were not the only two options. It wasn't just to give in to the entity or to cause nuclear war. You could also choose to not launch the missiles. And so I thought that that was great. And I'm so glad you brought that up, because I think that we have to face that. And it was so ironic in a way, too, that people were so in the film upset about that all around the president going, what do we do? And then sure enough, even though she chose not to push the button when it was time for the big boom, everyone was fine without having the entity around. You know, so it's like you said, like you can live without it. You can rebuild. It would actually be okay. The world wouldn't spontaneously combust just because we didn't have internet anymore.
Yeah. I can't watch Netflix.
Right.
Yeah. This is why you should have physical media, folks.
We're getting into that now.
I could rant on that for hours, but anyway. I'm not going to. Yes, exactly. Not going to do it. We talked, of course, a little bit about the idea of connections that this movie kind of creates, that 30-year saga. And I just wanted to talk a little bit about the idea that some of the things we do bring back, we bring back William Donlow, the CIA analyst from the first film. And we take the character Jasper Biggs and turn him and say, actually, he's Jim Phelps Jr., the original villain from the first film. You know, the rabbit's foot wasn't a, you know, biological weapon, but a digital ooze that actually kind of, I love they called it basically a digital ooze, because it was like, ooze. I was like, is this the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles? But that helped create the entity, right? And so I just wanted to ask you about that, because how did that all work for you then, to be bringing back some interesting players from, previous films, or kind of reworking, you know, the things like the rabbit's foot and all, or, you know, taking characters in a direction we might not have expected when we were first, you know, watching this movie, like the fact that, oh, that's Jim Phelps' son. What?
Yeah, it's funny, because that actually wasn't the most shocking to me. I was the most surprised and excited about William Donlow coming back, because, to be honest, especially by this point, I'm sure most people forgot about him. You really remember more just the scene itself right before he comes in. But the fact that they bring back that character and then you suddenly go, oh, yeah, I can see the resemblance in the face. It's just the facial hair. He's a little bit older. I thought that was such an awesome callback. And then especially to weave it together with Ethan blaming himself, saying, if I had never done these things, then these bad things wouldn't have happened. And Donlow saying, it's all about perspective, because I may never have realized, if I didn't leave that place involuntarily, that I was so unhappy or that I was lonely. And I would have never met the love of my life. So actually, because you did what you did, you saved my life.
Yeah.
That, I think, was just the cherry on top. It was awesome. And I loved the bring back of the rabbit's foot and trying to frame that as one of Ethan's choices again, that they were pushing as, or Gabriel was pushing as, a choice that Ethan made to save one person over millions, and look where it's gotten him. And then reframing it later to say he could still make the right choice now to fix what's happening.
Yes.
And sorry to keep going, but that it wasn't that choosing his wife was wrong. So, you know, I mean that, you know, we all make the best choice that we can at the time with the information we're given.
Yes. Yes. Which is a really interesting thing to all that we were talking about before, because, you know, the entity kind of has this almost, it's seemingly godlike power of knowledge, right? Mm-hmm. And this is something they really should have brought out a little bit more in the movie, but what it lacks is actual wisdom, right?
Yeah.
The difference between knowledge and wisdom is huge. And that's the thing that Ethan has, right? Actually, that should have been something they added to Luther's speech, mm-hmm. I think, because driving that home, that just knowing things doesn't mean that you actually understand, right? We talked about the entity, you know, learning from humanity, right? But there's still something innate in humanity, right, that Ethan has that can still fool something that has all of this knowledge but no wisdom.
Yeah. Well,
that's fascinating to me.
And to be piggyback on what you're saying too, it calls back to the president's speech at the beginning where she says, "You never followed orders, but you never let us down."
Yes, exactly.
He was always the one to go rogue. And that's what he has over any machine with this all-knowing nature. Is that mm-hmm. he can exactly. reason and decide to do something completely unexpected.
Exactly. Exactly. Yes. And again, there's something that innate human nature of like instinct and all that. So, and that so perfectly ties into like you talking about Donlo, who really becomes the avatar of this idea that even those things that can seem the worst at some point in our life can be looked back on and we could see it again in hindsight and say, oh, that was actually the best thing that ever happened to me.
Yeah.
Now, that's not to say that everything like that was terrible in our lives will actually would be able to see on this side of eternity. But there are a lot of things in our lives that are like that. You know, I think I've mentioned here before, but you know, one of my favorite series is a book series that starts with The Sparrow and it ends with the book Children of God. And that is truly a book about eternal perspective, basically. What happens if we could actually see the ramifications of all of these things on a longer span of time? What might that do to our understanding if we could actually basically have a godlike view of perspective? And so I loved that because again, like William Donnell is like, this is the happiest I've ever been. Like I would never have met my wife. She's amazing. Like I wouldn't have given this up for the world.
Yeah.
Because of the outcome. And I loved that. And you know, I also really, I think the Jim Phelps Jr. character really kind of helps us to be able to have that moment, right, of that the choices that Ethan made with his father and kind of, you know, the way in which that character has kind of tried to make up for his father's indiscretions, right? Realizing truly, I think, I can just be my own person.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have to be driven by always trying to follow orders when it might not necessarily always be the best thing to follow orders. And, you know, again, Ethan shows us that. And so I think all of these things really, really worked as connections. And I really appreciate it, again, as we talked about, the kind of bringing everything full circle. And in fact, you know, what I found most interesting about this in bringing Ethan's story full circle is that this movie really mirrors that first film a lot. And especially, it's a much slower, more plot-driven film throughout the majority of it. And then you have that moment of incredible tension, right? In the first movie, it's stealing the knock list
mm-hmm.
from the CIA vault. Here, it's the submarine.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have this amazing finale that's just all out, right? In the first movie with the helicopter and the train and all that, have the same thing in this film with the planes and the bomb and all that. Mm-hmm. So I found this really fascinating because this movie really does bring Ethan's story full circle by creating a film which is very much more in the vein of the original film, because this is a slower, you know, type of movie. It is not just action, action, action the whole time. And at the same time, too, you know, that movie was about Ethan losing his whole team because he had been betrayed, mm-hmm. and then slowly be building a team. And what's interesting about this movie is that he's got this team now that he's built, and it's about them together instead of losing them all, being able to save the world together once again. I think that's really cool, which leads me to the question I've got to ask you. Mm-hmm. We do lose a member of the team.
Yep.
And unfortunately, RIP Luther. And so I wanted to ask you what you thought about that, because obviously he's been a fan favorite, you know, since I think his introduction in the second film, which is one of the few things that come out of that movie that was worth it.
Yeah. So I think that's a really big thing to mention here, because on the one hand, I'm glad that he is the only team member that we lost here. I don't think it would have served the story if it was like, and all of his team died again. But I do think that you needed to show something else to motivate stakes in this case, and that it was a good natural conclusion for Luther. It sucks that they had to do it with like him being ill as well. But I get the timing of it and everything. And then finally being able to give Benji his due to run the team. Because I do think you could see over time through all the movies, if you watch them in order, Benji building more leadership skills and more skills in general. So it was a cool way to get to give Benji his time to step into the spotlight, but in a way that felt good and a way that still honors Luther as a character.
Yeah, no, you know, it's interesting because there are a lot of allusions to other films in this movie. And, you know, Luther creating this kind of poison pill thing, right, and being sick and then having to die was so Dumbledore from the sixth book. You know, Dumbledore knows that he's dying, and so he's willing to, you know, to take the curse from Snape. So, you know, Malfoy won't have that on his conscience at that point. So very, very similar in that sense. And so I kind of love the actually that he was sick, because it made it easier to swallow, because we knew he was already going to die. And so for him to die, though, by doing the thing that he's best at and to save a friend and this, you know, whole city of London. Mm-hmm. I thought was great, and what a way to really honor that character, and I think do it really well. And so, a question I wanted to ask you, because Grace is a character who just came into this series in Dead Reckoning, and we had really speculated that the possibility of who Grace is, does she have the connection to Ethan? Are they related in some way? Like, could she be his daughter or something? And there's absolutely no real, I think, concrete discussion really in the movie of who she is, if she is anybody special or if she's just somebody there that, you know, again, Ethan has picked up along the way as he has all of these other, you know, crew members. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to ask you, you know, just what you thought about that, and did it work for you, especially, you know, there definitely does seem to be a chemistry, especially on her side, and an attraction and all that. And, you know, Ethan never, ever takes advantage of that. And in some ways, I feel like almost kind of shuts down there being any further closeness that they could have.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wondered how that ended up working for you.
So it's interesting. I'm sad that we didn't get more explanation as far as if there was any deeper connection there. But I could see it just being they wanted to leave it as someone he picked up along the way. But I did think it was interesting. I don't know if you caught at one point, it seemed like maybe she was going to betray Ethan. When he was initially talking to her in the decompression chamber, and she says, "What if you're the one to control the entity?" And I was literally in the theater going, "Oh no, girl, don't do it." you know, everyone thinks they can control it and they can't. Don't do it. So I'm glad they didn't go that way, but I really thought for a second she was going to betray him and try to take control of the entity.
I definitely had that thought process. And then, of course, she thankfully does that immediately where she's like, "No, the only person I trust to take the care of this is you. So if you're not going to do it, then no."
Right.
And, you know, I think what I've kind of come down to is this, you know, this movie does take place 2 months after the previous film. And the end of that film had a person that we absolutely knew Ethan was in love with, was Ilsa.
Mm-hmm.
Ilsa was his, you know, kind of perfect connector, right? Like they were basically the same person in many ways, that she was his equal in all the best ways. You know, they made an incredible couple. And so I think that I read this basically him. There's not a possibility of there being romance because, you know, the love of his life, since his, you know, his wife, who he truly did love, the next love of his life just died.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's no way that he's ready for any kind of relationship. And so I actually kind of appreciated that they don't really go there, because I felt like it would have been too soon.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's kind of what I've come down to. And in some ways, too, you know, I think we'll talk about the kind of the end and everything in a minute, and whether we want more and all that type of stuff. But, you know, there was another part of me that also kind of hoped in some ways that they would bring Ilsa back, just because I wanted Ethan to be able to kind of end up happy with somebody by the end of this series, because it feels like he's earned it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
After 30 years of putting his life on the line, this man deserves to be happy, to have some sort of happiness, to be able to enjoy, you know, a relationship with somebody he's not worried is going to end at any moment. And that would have been really nice. And so, but I understand why they didn't do that, because, you know, too many films, I think, bring people back and it just makes their deaths meaningless. And, you know, I think, you know, obviously her death ends up becoming a motivator for him in the end to continue to fight the good fight, because other people have, you know, given their lives for this. And if he doesn't continue, their sacrifice is in vain. And that's the last thing he could have happen.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a brilliant point. And I would echo the same feeling that I'm glad they didn't go that route with having him and Grace have a romantic connection. I think I defended it to myself as he had just been through too much and at least needs a break for a while before he's really interested in anything. And then also I kind of thought of it like, what if now his reward is knowing all the people that he has saved. You know, maybe he's just not supposed to end up with just one person. It's, you know, ending up with knowing all this good that he's made possible.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Now, I do have to ask you one more question before we kind of talk about the action, because I wish that there had been some romance in this film. And I really kind of hoped that Benji and Paris were going to end up together by the end of it because of the way their relationship evolved. And I just felt like it was so sweet and kind of really just honestly cute the way in which they slowly kind of came together as characters. And I do think that sometimes these movies kind of shied away too much from there being any kind of romance. And this is a place, since that's the last one, I just think that, again, somebody kind of getting that type of happy ending would have been nice to see.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, actually, because I was thinking maybe that was the direction you were going. I did think, especially in the scene where she's saving his life, you know, there was a bond there. She clearly was trusting that he's telling her the truth about where to do what. And then also he is depending on her. But I also just love their back and forth where they said that they wanted Gabriel alive and then she's straight up trying to shoot him in the head. And he's like, no.
Yes.
We said we want him alive. Yes. And she's like, yeah,
they
well, I want
so
him dead.
Great together. I could not agree with you more. I 100% agree with you on that.
Yeah.
And so, I just think it would have been really nice to be able to have.
Yeah.
It seems like in a lot of movies, in many ways, we're afraid to allow people to have romance. And it's like, I think it's a big part of our lives. I think it's okay for people to fall in love and get together.
Well, and especially when you're going through shared trauma, as they call it.
Exactly.
People bond.
Exactly.
You know,
that's a great point.
Thank you. There was one thing I forgot to mention that I just wanted to get your opinion on, but Theo Degas, who joined the team and was part of Don Lowe, his wife, and Theo were the three that had to cut the three wires at the same time on the last bomb. He was the prison guard that then decided to join the team. I have to say, personally, I felt like although he's a good actor, the character was really unnecessary. And I really didn't like when they were asking who was going to stay and who was going to go inside. He said, I'll just stay. Like, whatever. It felt like there was no reason for him to say, I will stay and die.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't make any sense.
Yeah. It's interesting because I think he works best as the character who is a juxtaposition between Jasper, Jim, and him, right? He's the one who can have all the training and everything, and yet he can basically see Ethan's side, and in some ways I think he because he doesn't have the there's no history there between those two characters and family, he's able to, I think, accurately assess Ethan. And so to me, that's how he works best as the character. And then I thought it was interesting because, you know, in the end, the reason in which they are able to actually survive, Don Lowe and his wife, is because there is a third person there. Mm-hmm. Because they all have to cut those wires at the same time. They have to do three of them at a time and at one time. And if he hadn't stayed, they'd have all been dead.
Mm-hmm.
And so I found that to be interesting, the way they made that work, like his sacrificial choice of basically saying, I'm going to stay and guard them, make sure that they can keep this thing from going nuclear. And that so that hopefully you guys can complete your mission. And then it ends up saving everybody's life in there. Again, it really came down to almost that idea of like the choices, mm-hmm. you know, our life is a culmination of our choices. But I can see what you're saying because he doesn't get a ton to do in the film. And you know, more than that, and we can talk about there at the end, but I kind of think he's the setup as like, if we are going to possibly continue this series, like he's part of the team, mm-hmm. you know? And so, yeah, but I, you know, I can totally get what you're saying.
Yeah.
So,
but thank you for adding, you know, your perspective on it too. I just wanted to see if I was the only one getting that vibe.
No, I mean, yeah, that's great. It's obviously, you know, I think that's the thing. This is what makes this type of stuff interesting, you know? Mm-hmm. And so it's one of the reasons I've been doing this show so long, it to be able to have those type of discussions. So, because, you know, there've been times on this podcast where my thought process has been changed because somebody just had a different perspective than I did, that I didn't think about it like that. And was like, oh
yeah,
yeah, you're right. So no, mm-hmm. I get it completely. Well, because this is a Mission Impossible movie, we have the action set pieces with the Sevastopol and, of course, the biplanes being the big set pieces. And in all honesty, strangely enough for a Mission Impossible movie, that's it. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to ask you, how did you feel about that? And did they do everything that you would want them to do in a Mission Impossible movie without feeling like, oh, you wish you had had more?
I really think that here, less was more. They really made such good use of those two sequences that mm-hmm. I think that it was okay that it wasn't similar to like Fallout, for example, where it's just everything was action-packed, or even Dead Reckoning. I mean, that cliff jump, I will remember forever. And I told my husband, there is no substitute for seeing that scene in the theater in Dolby.
It's true.
And we saw this one in Dolby because I said, that's what we got to do. but honestly, also being someone who is, in the past, I tried scuba diving before. And I am actually afraid of just how deep the ocean is. And I only want to go so far. That whole scene with the Sevastopol was terrifying, especially seeing it in Dolby and having my seat shaking. And then same with, I actually had a friend when I was 16 that passed away in a plane crash.
Oh my goodness.
And so then seeing scenes where there might be a plane crash was also terrifying. So I was like, this is my two worst fears in the same movie. And I'm just,
oh my gosh,
crawling in my seat.
Oh, wow.
But that speaks to how well they were done. So,
yeah.
Sorry to get a little dark there, but I thought they were so well done as far as the pacing, the composition with the music for those scenes, and definitely feeling the weight of what could possibly go wrong. I was incredibly impressed. And I think what all of us love about the Mission Impossible movies is Tom Cruise doing his own stunts. And every movie you're just going, is the man insane? Does he want to die?
I agree with you. I think you said it perfectly when you said less is more in this film. And I remember the second time I saw the film this last weekend, I was sitting with some friends and the wife, she said, I didn't feel that 3 hours at all, because this movie is basically 3 hours long.
Yeah.
And I think that speaks to the quality of the movie and the storytelling, that you didn't need the action to get you there.
Mm-hmm.
What you had was good storytelling. I mean, the incredible filmmaking nature of the Sevastopol, where it that you know that is an incredibly huge gimbaled set that is full of water that they are rotating to make all of that happen, because it's all real. And any digital trickery that they're using in there, you can't tell what's digital trickery. Mm-hmm. It's just phenomenal. Of course, you know, maybe this is the first mission that was impossible, or maybe the second mission, because this is the second time that Ethan has died and have to been brought back to life.
Right.
And so I kind of enjoy that. Obviously, it is insane. There's no way he would have survived whatsoever with the temperature of the water and all of that. I mean, he just would be dead.
Getting the bends, yes, is a real thing. And that also, yes, is terrifying. So, yeah, no.
Yeah.
That combined with the temperature of the water, like you're saying, you would just be straight up dead.
Yeah, I mean, you would have been frozen immediately because that water is so cold. But anyway, those are the type of things, like, this is a Mission Impossible movie. I let that stuff go. It's a movie.
Yeah.
And the whole biplane sequence I thought was phenomenal. The beauty of Gabriel as the villain is that I hate this man so much that I just can't wait till he's dead. Like, I even turned to my wife and I was like, I can't wait till this guy's dead. You know, I just wanted to curse so badly because he's so ugh. And then the way he dies is just so poetic justice, right?
Yes.
He's so sure of himself, and boom, he's dead. And I loved it. And so I thought that whole thing was just phenomenal. And so, you know, to me in this, when they did action, they did a great job in it. And I didn't miss that it didn't have more action, because I felt like the story legitimized the action they did have.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I want. So,
and I agree with you about Gabriel. I just gotta say, he was so smarmy and he always gets away with things, and you're ready for it.
100% agree. 100% agree. So I guess one of the bigger questions that kind of comes up with the end of this film, before we wrap up here, is, should this be the end? I mean, and they've said it's the end. Tom Cruise has said it's the end, but it does kind of almost seem as though the movie sets up that the team could go on with basically Grace as the leader. You could see basically Ethan possibly being the head of the IMF, which would make sense, I think. And so, I wanted to ask you, do you want more? Do you think there should be more? Or do you think they should just do something that Hollywood can't seem to do and just let this be the end that it should be?
The latter. I would like to leave it where it is. I feel like it's going out on a high note, and you don't want to then come in for a cash grab later and ruin something. And so I really, as much as I always want more of Impossible missions, I think that I like the way it's wrapped up here. So, and that's how I feel about it ultimately, but I do see how there's been a lot of back and forth, actually. Tom Cruise said that there could be possibilities for things to be revived. But then later he comes back and says, well, we changed it to The Final Reckoning for a reason. It's final.
Right.
So is it going to get more? Is it not? We're not sure. But I'm okay with it stopping here. What about you?
Yeah, I mean, I'll put it this way. I think that there are very few franchises where every movie subsequently, besides two,
mm-hmm,
Either is just as good or better than the previous film. And that's an incredible run. And whereas I think that you could absolutely try to continue this with Grace as the leader there, and you know, if you had Benji back and those kind of things. And you know, maybe Ethan, again, is the head of the IMF, which would be interesting. But I just think the problem is that I can't see people coming to a Mission Impossible movie where Tom Cruise is not the main person because he's so synonymous with this franchise. It's not just the character of Ethan, but it's just the franchise itself, right? I think it's the same thing that Lucasfilm realized about Indiana Jones.
Mm-hmm.
Indiana Jones is Harrison Ford. This is not a James Bond series, I don't think, where you can just plug and play with different characters. And so, yeah, I think this should be the final reckoning. And I think this should be the end because, like you mentioned, I mean, it's such a satisfying ending.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't want anything to come in and mess that up. And I would rather not have more and just be able to, you know, watch this series for the rest of my life, you know, minus two, and enjoy every single film in it, than them kind of do what they did with the Jason Bourne series, where then, you know, even though I love Jeremy Renner, them trying to bring him in and make like the same type of movie, but different with a different character. And it just didn't work.
Yeah.
I don't want that to happen with this. So this should be the end. Well, Christy, this is like a 3-hour movie. And I feel like we could keep going on this movie.
Probably.
for quite a bit longer. But I'm very interested to see where you are then in your ratings for Mission Impossible, The Final Reckoning.
I feel like everything big that I would have said I've already gotten out there, but ultimately I'm just really impressed. I left excited, whereas, you know, going in was apprehensive at how they were going to do this. And I think that I was really glad to see how things wrapped up. So really, there wasn't anything much that disappointed me or took off any points other than the one character I thought maybe was a little unnecessary. So ultimately, for me, it is a 4.5 out of 5. I got to figure out what I'm going to rate with. The golden memory stick. But what about you?
Yeah, you know, I think for me, that I really, you know, look, it's hard to end a series, right? And there's so much that's kind of against you when you're trying to bring something to an end. And yet I felt like this movie really did a very good job of making me feel good when it was over. Is it my favorite Mission Impossible film? It's not.
Yeah.
But does that matter? No. And in that, you know, there were a couple things in there where it's just like, it's not just what I wish would have happened, but I felt like, since this is supposed to be the final film, allowing there to be some resolution for characters that gave you a sense of like real hope, again, like a Benji and a Paris romance, something like that, I just think would have been really nice. And so, or is there, you know, a further connection with Grace and Ethan, or is there not? And all, so those minor things. This is a 4.5 out of 5 stars for me as well. Like I absolutely agree with you. And you know, it's interesting because I think the last 3 films were 5 stars for me, and this is 4.5. That doesn't make it a failure on any level, right? And the biggest thing is that I come out of this final film so thankful that they did such a good job. It's a really good movie.
Yeah.
And it ends the series, I think, really strongly. And you can't really ask for more from a final film, I think, than that. Because we've seen so many movies, you know, fall flat on their faces, and this one doesn't. And so I'm really thankful that it didn't.
I'm so glad to hear that. I wasn't sure exactly if you were going to end up the same as me. So I'm so glad we're both on 4.5 out of 5.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Christy, it's been so much fun talking about this. But, you know, if people wanted to catch up with you and talk to you a little bit more about Mission Impossible or anything else, you know, where would they find you?
Well, of course, you can always find me on Instagram at @BespinBell. And I'm on Letterboxd, which I need to be more active on. I'll finally go back in and update some stuff. I need to put this one in. 4.5 out of 5. There we go. And then I'm also on Facebook. And what about you?
Well, yeah, you could find me all over the place under the name MattRushing02, all over social media. So if I'm on that platform, just find me there. And of course, you know, you can also find me here on the TFM network with a bunch of other shows that have to do with Star Trek. All of the great Star Trek franchises that we love. I'm talking about a lot of them with Chris Jones. We have an absolute blast doing that. So I do hope that you will check all those out. And over on the Nerd Party Network, you find me doing a couple of shows. One is Outpost with Dre Kaufman, where we talked about every single chapter of the Harry Potter series, one chapter at a time. And then, of course, you'll find me over on Aggressive Negotiations with the great John Mills as we are talking about Star Wars each and every week.
And before we do our official sign-off, I just wanted to add in one more thing. Also, not only for you, but also to just reward everybody for listening to the end. I wanted to share that this is my last official episode as co-host with you. But it won't be my last ever. But I just wanted
Which
to make sure I said that.
Good news. So I'm definitely glad that this will not be the final episode. And, you know, I think it's crazy, you know, how long we've been doing this show together. If I had known you were going to do this, I would have been able to look it up. But honestly, it's been years that we've been doing this together. Quite a few years. So
I can chime in on that because I did look it up.
Oh, you did. There you go. See, yeah. Somebody was prepared.
Sometimes. It's been 10 years.
Wow.
We met with our spouses at Star Wars Celebration in 2015 in Anaheim, well, California.
Danae wasn't there.
Oh, okay.
But we did meet at Dragon Con the next year.
Yes, yeah. Okay. But you met Michael at Anaheim well. And I know one of my first episodes was just as a guest, a trial run, talking about Diamonds Are Forever. And also did one with us talking about Passengers.
Yes, yes. That was right. That's the first major one that you were on where you're like, yeah, you're going to be the co-host.
Yeah, which was crazy. And so I really wanted to go back and give the details and also just say thank you to you. Because for one, if you hadn't started this, there wouldn't have been a show for me to try out on. And also hadn't, you know, trusted me to know what I'm talking about and do the work behind the scenes to be prepared for things and let me come on and do this. I wouldn't have gotten into podcasting.
Yeah. Well, thank you for saying yes all those years ago. It's been so much fun. The 602 Club isn't ending. We're going to be continuing. We'll have some fun guest hosts that'll be coming on. And again, as we mentioned, this isn't Christy saying goodbye forever. But it was just the opportunity and kind of time for her to step back from trying to do this as regularly as she has been. You know, for anybody who doesn't know, podcasting it's a ton of work. And whether it's, you know, going to the movies or watching shows or any of those things, it takes a lot of time behind the scenes to actually make this stuff happen. And so I'm so grateful to you for I mean, the fact that it's been 10 years is insane. And I'll look forward to the time when, you know, you come back and, you know, talk about something that you're excited about. But, it's been a real blast, and, I am going to stop talking so that, I don't get too emotional, but thank you so much for joining us.
And y'all come back now, you hear.